Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Sister Helen Prejean, who reads from and discusses her important second book, The Death of Innocence, an eyewitness account of wrongful execution, published by Vintage. In the weeks to come, we have Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, Allegra Goodman, John Grogan, Rita Mae Brown, Francis Mays, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a moment. It's time to begin.
Good evening, and welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. Thank you so much for coming and supporting our events, and thank you for supporting independent bookstores. Before we begin, if I could just ask people to silence their cell phones, it'll make everything much nicer for our guest. Also, this will be podcast on authorsontourlive.com, so they're taping it, so if you want to visit that website at a later date, you can see what other authors have been added to it. Tonight, I'm honored to introduce best-selling author and award winner and death penalty opponent, Sister Helen Prejean. I feel like I know Sister Helen not only from her first book, Dead Man Walking, but also from her nephew, a friend of mine, who introduced me to her fine work. When I read Dead Man Walking and later saw the film, I was introduced to a new point of view. In her second book, The Death of the Innocents, an eyewitness account of wrongful executions, Sister Helen continues with her fight to abolish the death penalty with stories of two death row inmates she spiritually advised who were executed without proof of guilt. Her arguments for abolishing the death penalty are well-defined legally and morally in the book. Sister Helen is in the Order of Sisters of St. Joseph of Medai. She began her prison ministry in 1981 when she dedicated her life to the poor of New Orleans in the St. Thomas Housing Project. It was then she became pals with death row inmate Patrick Saunier. She became his spiritual advisor and witnessed his execution. In 1994, Dead Man Walking was published and nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. The film came out in 1995 and has been made into an opera since. Since then, Sister Helen has been interviewed by many newspapers, magazines, and news shows. She also gives at least about 120 talks a year, and she's the honorary chairperson of Moratorium Campaign, a group gathering signatures for worldwide moratorium on the death penalty. And in March, she will be honored by the Standard of Christ Award, with the Standard of Christ Award by the Jesuit Volunteer Corps in the South. Because of her works and because she is living proof that one person can make a difference, please welcome Sister Helen Prejean.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Colorado's in the book, The Death of Innocence. You have one of the best criminal defense for capital cases in the whole United States, and you show that when people get good defense, you don't have many death sentences. And so I use Dave Wymore and the capital defense of Colorado in this book. Glad to be here, have good friends here. And I walk into the store, and Reuben is in the store. He was my neighbor in New Orleans. We're all in the diaspora. Everybody's been strewn by the hurricane all over the place. And here's Reuben right in here tonight. I said, what are you doing in Denver? He goes, what are you doing in Denver? And here we are. I am in Denver, am I not? So I want to talk about writing. I was an English major, but, I mean, you know, I was not like one of those child writers who wanted to, you know, scribble poems and want to be a writer and start being a writer. I was an English major, but it was mostly to teach. And now, I did keep a spiritual journal, and but life happens, and you know how they say a book like starts screaming inside you to be written. And the way it happened for me was the first part of Dead Man Walking begins that journey of making my way over to poor people in New Orleans, the very ones you saw in the Superdome. the very ones you saw left at the convention center. How do you have an evacuation plan for a city that does not include 150,000 people that don't have cars? Well, you know how you do that? The same way that we allow in our inner cities these pockets of poverty to continue, where the public schools are terrible, the police beat people up, people are forced to live in housing that's substandard because we started cutting affordable housing budgets in this country back in the Nixon years. And all of this is a conglomeration. There's more than one way to drown. And Hurricane Katrina showed us, pulled aside the veil for a little while and showed the other America. Then the veil has been pulled back now, and poverty is unseen in this country. And it took me a while to wake up to the fact that just from my religious belief of what it really means to be a Christian meant to be over in those neighborhoods where people who were struggling against racism and poverty. And so that was really the beginning of my journey. And if I had never gotten involved with poor people in New Orleans, I wouldn't be going to the prison, or I wouldn't be going to death row. It was like there was a grease track straight from the St. Thomas housing projects to prisons. And I mean, I began to notice as soon as I moved in the neighborhood, the way our friends used to talk about what college you're going to go to, people were talking about what prison so-and-so was in, and every family had someone in prison. We have astounding, very disturbing statistics about 2.1 million people in the United States now are in prison. And one in every three young African-American men from the ages of 18 to 29 are in the prison system. And it's like, what is that saying to us? I mean, that we just throw people away to that extent. Every year, the equivalent of the population of Seattle is released from prison. And what has happened to human beings in prison? You know, have they been educated? Do they have a sense of vocation? Do they have a sense of worthwhile work, of being a citizen? Most often, they have been really, you know, all kinds of things happen to you in prison. And I didn't know much about prison. And where our state prison is, the Louisiana State Penitentiary, when I went to Girl Scout camp, Camp Merrydale was right across the highway from Angola, the prison. And so in our little cabins at night, everybody's telling scary stories about the criminals, the convicts are going to get out and they're going to come get us. And I never dreamed how my life was going to be connected across that road over there at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. I mean, my car, the community car, knows just automatically how to go to the prison now. For me, it was about awakening. An awakening to brothers and sisters in the human family that for a long time I was not aware of. I realized when I moved into St. Thomas and kids were coming into the Adult Learning Center who had gotten to the 11th grade in public school and they couldn't read a third grade reader, and they're going to graduate in a year. And that's the kind of little Katrinas I'm talking about, that you're going to graduate from high school and you can't read. And our state, Louisiana, has some of the highest misery statistics in the United States. And it all stems out of poverty, racism, a legacy of slavery. And so once I got involved and I began to learn, then you just want to get involved. You can't be neutral in the face of seeing the suffering, seeing the drive-by shooting of children, seeing the young people knowing if they can get a job at minimum wage, they're still going to be in poverty. And so here comes the drug dealer, and they know where the money is. Kids aren't stupid. And you could just see this happening. And it's not to condone any of this, but it's like, you know, it's like climate, or it's like a river, and there are eddies and there are whirlpools. And I realized that I'd grown up privileged. And my father was a lawyer. I went to an excellent school, and by the time I left high school, I could read critically, I could do public speaking, I could formulate arguments, I could write, I knew how to punctuate sentences. And so I was equipped. I had the tools I needed for whatever goals in life I wanted to pursue. And these kids were never going to get that. And throw on top of it black dialect, because you're living in such a cordoned off section of the city, you mostly are only with other black people, black dialect. So when we try to get people jobs, and I'd say, well, look, this young woman was coming to the Adult Learning Center. She was bright. She was ace in everything, you know, and she needed a job. And so I went and gave a talk one time in St. Agnes Church, and I said, I'm looking to help people get jobs. And so this woman came up afterwards. She said, well, look, my husband's a dentist, and he needs a receptionist. And I said, great. Pamela will be great. I mean, she's overqualified to be a receptionist. She comes back from the interview, and I said, well, what happened? She said, I was the wrong color. I said, what do you mean? She said, she just said they didn't have the opening for me. So I called the lady, and I just said, I thought you said you had openings, and Pamela's really, she's really good. She said, sister, she said, you know, she talks in that black dialect. My husband is not going to want his patients getting a receptionist that talks in black dialect. And I'm just going, how many strikes can you have against you, like, to try to make your way? And so I'm at Hope House in St. Thomas, and I get an invitation one day coming out of the Adult Learning Center. If I want, hey, sit down, you want to write somebody on death row? It's 1982. I'd been there like a year. And I said, yeah, sure, I could write. You know, I was there to serve poor people, and I knew this. I didn't know very much about the death penalty. I was learning about all the social issues. But I knew this. Anybody sitting on death row in Louisiana was poor, and I was there to serve poor people. I mean, the saying in the neighborhood was capital punishment means them without the capital get the punishment. And, I mean, you can see why. Because you know you are never going to find a rich person on death row. And the reason you're not going to find them is not that sometimes they won't do terrible crimes. They're going to get a hotshot lawyer who's going to file 100 pretrial motions. The prosecutor's going to look at what he or she is up against and just go, no way. I'm not taking that on. We'll be embroiled in it for years, and it's going to be appeals. I just soon sit down with him, make a little bargain. Tell him plead guilty, we'll give him this sentence. Because a lot of bargaining goes on in the justice process. So I write this man, Pat Saunier, and that's the journey in Dead Man Walking. So I briefly want to just go through that, but then you can, you know, you can do that yourself, because I mainly want to put the attention on this. But I write the man, I end up being with him when he's executed, and I also meet the victims' families. And for me, it was like being stretched out across these two chasms of sorrow, of Pat and his brother Eddie, who had killed these kids, very sorry and remorseful for what they've done. Pat's facing execution, his mama, what it does to families, the unseen victims' families. There's a mother, their brothers, their sisters, who are going to have a loved one killed by violence. It's not a gun. It's the state of Louisiana who's going to strap them in an electric chair and pump electricity through their body and kill them. It's just as much a killing. And if you've ever seen a death certificate after an execution, they have to tell the truth then, because it says cause of death. So what do you think you write on the death certificate? Failure to breathe? They have to say it. It's homicide. But they usually put legal homicide. So I'm thrown into all of this. Never dreamed I was going to be involved in all of this. And then the stories of the victims' families were, to me, as much an unfolding and a realization. When I would go to support groups for victims' families who had had children murdered or someone murdered their family, the thing everybody was saying was nobody comes to see us because they don't know what to do with our pain. And like they were in such white-hot pain, so people were like staying away. And one woman even said, when I tried, I was talking to my good friend about my daughter, and she says, oh, Mary, shouldn't you be past it by now? Maybe you need to get some help. Because people don't know what to do with a lot of pain. And some of the parents said, I think they stay away from us because it's almost like they don't want to get too close to us. Maybe something bad will happen to them. Like my daughter's funeral after she was murdered, even a lot of her classmates didn't come. Like, don't get too close to that. It's so unspeakably awful. And so then I realized they're alone. And so what about them? What does our society need to do to heal them? And I begin to see the death penalty for what it is. I hear how prosecutors are saying, we're doing this for the victim's family. This is justice for the victim's family. And they're not going to tell you that 99% of all the people who have someone murdered in this country are not going to get this so-called justice. It's like 1% or 1.5% anybody who murders, and it's almost always 8 out of 10 times it's because you killed a white person. And when people of color are killed, forget it. It's not even a blip on the radar screen. So you have to be outraged over a death to seek the ultimate penalty. It's very costly. Takes years. Who's outraged over the death of which citizens? As if we could, we tried, it's almost been 30 years that we said we were going to decide who among us could live and who among us could die, and which were the worst of the worst crimes, murders for which the death penalty would be given. And that's the norm the Supreme Court actually gives. You don't give the death penalty for ordinary murders now, not for your garden variety murder, but only for the worst of the worst. Can you picture anybody, their mother killed or their brother, and say, oh, but it was an ordinary murder? As if we don't know how to do it. We don't know how to follow the guidelines, and natural prejudices and biases in a society take over. So the system's predominantly white, so when white people are killed and everybody identifies, that's when the death penalty's sought. When people of color are killed, it's a class thing too. A homeless person is killed in the streets of Denver tonight. Tomorrow, can you picture the prosecution saying, one of our valuable citizens has been murdered, and we are going to go for the death penalty? Can you picture it? And so, in any societies like that, you don't value every citizen the same. And so when you go to show your greatest amount of outrage over a crime, you're going to see that you got a little meritocracy of death seeping in there, that some people's lives are worth ultimate punishment and some people aren't even worth bringing to trial. Those were lessons I learned in Dead Men Walking. And the writing came out of the fire, because I walked out of the execution chamber when Pat had been executed on the night of April 5th, 1984. Never been involved in anything like this in my life. The most terrifying experience, because it's a cold calculus. It's a protocol of death. It's like not being like with somebody in a hospital, you know, where they're dying and they're fading, they're losing consciousness and they're not eating. He was fully alive and we're talking. And the only way I know he's going to be dead is with my mind and my watch and counting the hours. And then they come in to prepare his body for execution. And then I'm walking with him. And then I'm saying to him, look at my face. I'll be the face of Christ, the face of love for you. And he does. He looks at my face, and they kill him, and I'm there, and I walk out, and it's the middle of the night, and I throw up, because I'd never in my life seen anybody killed in front of my eyes. And my mission was born then. I didn't realize it, but I remember thinking, this is the middle of the night. The polls in Louisiana said everybody thought the death penalty was a great idea, but they were never going to see this, and you are never going to see it either. We've executed over 1,000 people in this country. If we had assembled those people in a stadium and shot everybody, you'd hear an uproar from here to kingdom come about the United States. But it's done in the Texas killing chamber, and it's done in the Louisiana and in Virginia and the southern states, as I point out in Death of Innocence, where slavery was practiced, do over 80% of the actual executions. You want to know who the real practitioners of the death penalty are? It's the southern states that practice slavery. Is this a surprise to us that maybe it has something to do with whites being threatened by people of color and controlling them? And when, the more you look into the history, the more you see. In fact, they did a study not long ago of the states and who practices the death penalty and who doesn't. And you can see the correlation. States that have a large population of people of color, where whites are threatened, those are the ones that are going to have the harshest system of punishment. And also, outside the prison in the middle of the night, I remember thinking, I've been a witness. People are never going to see this. I got to tell the story. And I didn't immediately think, oh, I'll write a book. In fact, I thought the opposite. I thought we already got books on the death penalty, and people who are for the death penalty read Rush Limbaugh, and the people against it read Amnesty International. Like, why should I write a book? I mean, it's a lot of trouble to write a book. It's going to take years to write a book, and I really didn't see that I should write a book. But what I did begin to do was, and there's a lot of good oral tradition around Louisiana. I mean, you know, people tell stories. You know, you sit around a meal in the backyard where you're eating a boiled crawfish for 3 hours and drinking a Dixie Long Neck beer. And, I mean, if you don't tell stories, I mean, you're boring. I mean, you're going to be having 3 hours at a meal. I mean, what you're going to do, just eat? And so it was the natural thing was just to begin to talk and to begin to go to any captive audience who would hear me. I mean, if you Google me up, I am the death penalty nun. Death penalty none, that's me. And that's the way my identity began. I just began to talk to sociology classes at Loyola University. And I remember, I mean, before the book and the movie and all this, believe me, we talk about some little bitty audiences, like St. Christopher's Nursing Home in New Orleans, and they made this announcement after lunch. Who wants to hear the death penalty none? And three people. And so we go off in this little like parlor, and I start telling them the story and all, and I'm not kidding, after 10 minutes, two of them were gone. Just one lady was listening, and I had my eyes locked with that lady like, you're it, don't leave me, this is it. Then I began to write, just because when you write, you can put faces on things. And we were doing that out of St. Thomas. I was writing stories of the people that I was with, because there was a lot of misunderstanding. People saying, all those people on welfare, they like being on welfare. Those people, why don't they get their family values together? And they don't see all the things impinging on people at work. And I went, they don't know these people. So I began to write in St. Thomas, in the little newspaper that we had. And so then, Providence. I just got to say Providence, because somebody said, look, I got a good literary agent in New York. Why don't you just send your stuff? I began to write for magazines then. I began to tell the stories. And Gloria Loomis in New York, she called me and she said, yeah, I'll be your agent. She said, you have stories, personal stories to tell about the death penalty. You're not just doing a book like a lawyer, or you're not doing a book like a sociologist. You're telling personal stories and really taking people over to both sides of your experience. Nobody's written a book like that before. Yeah, you should write that book. And so she told me, you write a proposal, like 2 pages, then you do a proposed table of contents, and then you write like 3 chapters. Doesn't matter what order they're in, because I'm going to bring it to a publisher, so they have to see that you can write. So I wrote. Took me 9 months to do that. Sent it to her. I came back from, we had a long march from Florida to Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta, trying to get media attention, trying to get attention about the death penalty and all. And there was a letter waiting for me. And it was from Random House. And there was this man who had written this letter. His name was Jason Epstein. And up at the top of the stationery there, it said, Managing Editor, Random House. And he said, why don't you come to New York? I'd like to talk to you. Gloria brought in your proposal, and I'd like to talk to you about a book. So the next thing I know, I'm going to New York City to go talk to this editor about my book, possible book. I mean, I didn't get my hopes up. And I went with Liz Scott, who is a friend, and she was a comedic writer, and she had a character like a Southern Irma Bombeck, and her name was Modine Gunch. And her book, she had an editor too, and she was going to go talk about, and her book was Never Heave Your Bosom in a Front Hook Bra. And I had a book on the death penalty. We were both going up to New York to see our editors. And I stayed with somebody in New Jersey, because I couldn't stay in any hotel in New York, like $500 to just stay in a hotel. And so then took the subway over, and then I was supposed to report to this man, Jason Epstein, on the 11th floor. I think Random House only rents the 11th floor. That's what Random House is. And coming outside the building, man, I hear Random House. And I'm on the elevator, and we're stopping at the different floors, and it was children's literature, and it was reference books, and it was adult fiction. I go, the whole building is Random House. People come in with little carts in the elevator. If you ever been in a big publishing house, everybody's doing books. And then I get onto the floor. There's a receptionist. Or you're here to see Mr. Epstein. Yes, we'll just sit right there. And I'm looking on the wall. And here's Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, Elaine Pagels, all these people. And he was their editor. And they all got their pictures hanging on the wall. So I sit in a chair till they call me in. It's kind of like going to the dentist, but not quite. He has this wonderful office, overlooks the Hudson River. And we sit down. We have one of the best discussions on the death penalty I ever had. And while we're having the discussion, he says, because I think he'll say, well, thanks so much for coming. We'll get back to you. It was nice talking to you. And so we're right in the middle of the discussion. Then he said, we're going to do your book. I went, oh, he has some kind of authority, this man. I went, you know, I was surprised. I really was. Later, my friend Jason DeParle writes for the New York Times. He said, Helen, people would kneel on crushed glass to get a call from Jason Epstein. He's probably the most influential editor in North America. And he's going to do your book. I said, yeah, he's going to do my book. I come home surprised. I got a contract under my arm, go to the community, and I said, I think I need to write this book. I got a contract, and I thought it was a lot of money. They gave me $20,000. I mean, $20,000. That was like a lot. And I wrote the book, and Jason was invaluable to me about how you shape a story, because he said, write the whole thing and then come to me after I've seen the whole first draft. And by the way, he told me, you know why most people don't start books and don't finish a book? What do you think is the reason? Why you would start a book and you wouldn't finish it? People say, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a book. And they get started and they don't finish it. No deadline. Well, I guess that's part of it. Don't think it's good enough? Fear. You know what it is? They start on chapter one and they polish it forever. He said, push through and do the whole thing. And don't worry that it's not perfect. And then we'll work on editing it. So I did that. And I went and met with Jason 1 year later. And he said, you wait too long to talk about the crime. Remember, you're a Roman Catholic nun. You're a spiritual advisor to a murderer on death row. And people are going to think you're overly sympathetic to this guy. And they're not going to trust you. You got to tell the crime within the first 10 pages of this book. Because if you don't, they're not going to trust you. And you, in fact, you have to be unblinking in your outrage at the crime. And then you have to slowly reveal the outrage you feel at what the state is going to do to kill this person. And then invaluable things about words. Like I'm talking about going in the death house, and I talk about like this iron, feeling this cold iron like clasp on my stomach, and that my fingertips were cold. He said, now choose the stomach or the fingers. Because he said you want to make one impression and then you want to move on. Like if you're walking and a pebble falls on your head, well, you feel it. If you're walking down a path and pebble after pebble keeps hitting you on the head, you don't feel it. One description, then move on. Because the secret of good writing is to move in your story and not repeat. Or you say something and you think you said it so well, so you say it again. Repetition's the next thing. Bogs you down, slows you down. And he taught me all these valuable things about writing. And then he says, look, you're a nun and you're visiting this guy on death row. Don't presume people understand the nature of the relationship. Be very transparent that you don't have something kinky going on with this death row inmate, because they're going to go, man and a woman, yeah, she's trying to say it's a religious thing. Don't tell me she's a nun. I mean, I had a reporter after he was executed say, were you in love with Patrick Sonnier? I mean, you got all that stuff that goes on. Be very transparent about your relationship. And then when he looked at the first draft, he said, look, all the information about the death penalty, the racism, poverty, and all, you have all that in footnotes. The secret of good writing, because only a scholar is going to read your footnotes. Secret of good writing is to tell the story and you shingle in important information, because people are going to read your book for the story So by the time they close that book, they have learned all the important things you want them to know. And so Dead Man Walking came out in 1993. And then in 1994, it came out in paperback. Susan Sarandon read it, pestered Tim Robbins for 9 months till he read it, and then they did the film of Dead Man Walking. And I just want to say, while I'm on that, before I leave the book to go to this one, the play of Dead Man Walking, Tim Robbins has written the stage play of Dead Man Walking, because it's all about getting people to reflect on the death penalty, because it's not one of the moral issues that affect people personally. So, I mean, how many times you get up in the morning and say, oh, let me reflect on the death penalty? I mean, it just doesn't touch most of us. So the way to get it out is books and then the arts. And Tim has written a stage play, and we brought, where is Carrie and where are those? We just want to be able to give them to you. We'll put them out with the books as well. Thank you. Because they're going to be doing the play, the Denver Victorian Playhouse, February 23rd through March 5th. They have 8 performances. And Tim has constructed the play to take you on the journey over to both sides in the same way he did the film. And I just met with the cast tonight. So we're going to make these available to you, and perhaps you want to check that out. The arts are the only way we have. Books, where you bring people into the story, stage play, film, music, to bring people into the social issues of the day. Death of Innocence. I never dreamed I was going to write a second book either. I also never dreamed that as I continued to accompany people on death row, that I was going to begin to accompany people that I believe were innocent and were being executed. And where this book takes you, the journey of this book, is into 2 stories, Dobie Gillis Williams in Louisiana, African-American man. I visited him and accompanied him for over 7 years. He had an IQ of 65. He was executed in 99. If he had been, his date of execution had been 2 years later, the Atkins decision of the Supreme Court would have saved his life, where finally the Supreme Court says maybe we shouldn't execute the mentally retarded. And it was too late to save Dobie's life. His story will break your heart. It opens in the death house with his mama, with his family, telling him goodbye. It starts. When I first met him, I was struck by his name, Dobie Gillis. And then when I heard he had a brother named John Boy, another TV character, I knew for sure his mama must like to watch a lot of TV. Betty Williams, Dobie Williams' mama, is here now in the death house of the Louisiana State Penitentiary, a terrible place for a mama to be. It's January 8th, 1999 at 1 p.m., and she's here with family members, 2 of Dobie's lawyers, and me as spiritual advisor. We're all waiting it out with Dobie to see if the state is really going to kill him this time, because he had been brought into the death house 2 other times, got within an hour of death and was given a stay of execution only to be brought back again and then again and killed the third time. Dobie's story is the story of one more black man in a southern town, a white woman killed, and a young black man railroaded through a trial with an all-white jury. And you're going to go, how can this still be happening in the United States of America? And how can we have a Supreme Court and appeals courts that uphold it all? Aren't there constitutional protections assured every American, especially for the lone individual brought up against the powers of the state for your very life, like to effectiveness of counsel, like to due process under law, like to equal justice under law, like to a fair and impartial jury of your peers? And Dobie looks out and it's an all-white jury, and he's on trial for his life for supposedly killing this white woman in the town. And there's the story. And then Dobie's killed. And Dobie's story, he was just very brave. He was scared of needles. It's lethal injection. He had rheumatoid arthritis. He You know why? What the catalyst for writing the book was, after Dobie had been executed, we standing in his mama's kitchen in her little trailer after the funeral, and she says to me, "You know, Sister Helen, nobody ever heard Dobie's voice. The prosecutor, they were always talking to the news media, but the news media never came to us and asked us. And at trial, they never heard Dobie's voice. Nobody ever heard Dobie's voice. Sister Helen, maybe you can write the story, and you can be Dobie's voice." And I promised her that I would. You promise a mama something, and you got to do it. And so that's how the book began. So Dobie's story is first. Second story is Joseph Odell, a man in Virginia. And here's how I got involved with Joseph Odell. Just know that he was on death row in Virginia for 11 years. And Virginia is another one of the former slave states that does the most executing. And I get a breathless phone call one day. And it went something like this. "Sister Helen, my name is Laura Ears, and I'm working with Centurion Ministries. And we take the cases of people who claim to be innocent, and we check out and see maybe if people are innocent. Well, this man on death row in Virginia, now I know a lot of people say they're innocent, but I believe he is innocent, and I want to ask you to help us because the state of Virginia is marching him toward execution, and he's never even had one full evidentiary hearing by the courts because Virginia has this 21-day rule, and they have that if you don't bring evidence of innocence 21 days after your trial, no Virginia court will hear your evidence. And they are marching him right to the execution chamber. So I think we need to have a press conference. And, like, would you come? Like, you know, because of the movie and you and Susan Sarandon, like, maybe you'll attract press. And we could tell the people of Virginia, please get involved in this case and don't let Virginia kill Joseph Odell." I mean, is that a long shot or what? Virginia and a governor that doesn't bat an eye about executing people. And to have a press conference to try to get Joseph Odell's story out to the people of Virginia to say, don't let this man be executed, when it's just he's one more person up for execution that Virginia was doing. I mean, among those, you know, over 80% of the executions happening in that state. I heard the desperateness in her voice, though. And I said, "Laurie, I'll come. I can only come for a day if you can fly me in and out. Go do the press conference." And on the way, I began to read about this man who for 11 years had been on death row in Virginia, and you begin to realize that he was his own defense, because the defense appointed to him, he found out, was in cahoots with the prosecution and telling him everything. He said, "It'd be better for me to defend myself." So, and he's described what happened. Every day he's there at trial, and then he goes back in his cell and he gets a bologna sandwich and a glass of Kool-Aid. He's allowed one phone call, one legal book, and he has to ask for legal pads from which he prepared his defense. And if you just take this all the way through, realize that every court in the land, every appeals court and the Supreme Court itself, did not find that that was ineffectiveness of counsel. They said, well, he chose to defend himself, so, hey, take the consequences. I find out a woman. He had been in a bar. A woman was found strangled and murdered. Then they claimed that he had blood on his clothes, and it was the victim's blood, and they sent it to the Virginia Crime Lab, and they had a mannequin dressed there, which the jury kept looking at, of a man with a blue jacket with blood all over it, and the victim's dress with blood all over it, and they're saying, yeah, it was the victim's blood on Joseph Odell's clothes. And they're saying the hair matched, and the cigarette and the tire tracks matched his car, and all this kind of stuff. And then while the trial is going on, suddenly, surprise witness one day, a guy who was in a jail cell with Joseph. And when Joseph sees him walk in, and he takes the oath to tell the truth, and he points to Joe and he said, "Joe, you confessed to me that you killed Helen Chartney. You know you did." And Joe stands up and he goes, "That's a lie." And he had no way to disprove it. He had no way. You're not supposed to do surprise witnesses. Prosecutors are supposed to let defense know when they're going to, what eyewitnesses or people they're going to present, and defense is supposed to present to prosecution. So all this was happening to Joseph. And all the evidence was circumstantial. He was asking. Barry Sheck got involved in the case and said, there's this really super-duper DNA test. Even if you have just a microscopic amount of material, that we can get the testing done and we can prove. And Helen Sharpner had been raped as well. Just let him get the DNA test, and it can, and they won't let him get the test. And what happens, we have 122 wrongfully convicted people in this country who are telling their horror stories on nightly TV news stories. How did that happen? And the way it happens is, in this country, there's an assumption. If you've had your day in court and you're found guilty and they sentence you to death, you must be guilty. And then people think, well, we got all these appeals courts, and so if a mistake happened to take place at their trial, well, surely the appeals courts are going to remedy that. And with Joseph, so what happens is he gets caught in the procedures of the appeals courts and said, oh no, timeline, should have done this earlier, should have raised that objection here. And he goes, but I was defending myself. Sorry, you chose to, so now you can't say it's ineffectiveness of counsel. And they wouldn't let him get the test. In the end, they are going to execute him, and Virginia destroys the evidence so he could never be tested. And why did it take me 4 years to write this book? I can tell you one of the reasons it took me 4 years, because a couple of things needed to happen, and one of them was that I get an email from the jailhouse snitch, Steve Watson, the one who stood there and said, Joe, you confessed to me. And all the other evidence was kind of circumstantial, but that really put the nail in his coffin, because the jury's trying to sort all this out. So they go, well, he confessed, so that did it. And I get an email and a phone call from Steve Watson, and the email says, I've retired now, and Joe, I keep seeing Joe's face that comes into my living room. He said, I lied. I was in a tight pinch. I just needed to get out of jail. I did that. I lied. Joe died. And what do I do now? And I end the Joseph O'Dell story with the confession of Steve Watson. The jury doesn't know that he lied. And that's what we're finding. The faulty system, the structure of it is, because you have inadequate defense, because people for the most part are poor, the jury can't get to the truth. And these poor people are asked to play God. They're asked to, now listen to all the evidence you're given. They don't know they're not getting all the evidence. They don't know what the prosecutor is withholding and not telling them the truth. They don't know all the shenanigans that can go on and they're only getting a partial truth. They don't know the jailhouse snitch is lying. And then they're going to carry that now the rest of their life. If they ever read this book, you, the reader of this book, know more facts about what happened than that poor jury did, who were asked to be the arbiters of life and death and sentence this person to death because they thought they were doing the right thing. Something else happened with Joseph O'Dell. And I get this call from Laurie Ers again one day. I got to give you a little background that a member of the Italian Parliament, Luciana Nere, who belonged to the Human Rights Commission of the Italian Parliament, had seen a little snippet on the Joseph O'Dell case. Next thing you know, they got delegations of the Italian Parliament coming over to Virginia to see Joseph O'Dell. Next thing you know, you got the mayor of Palermo, Leo Lucas Orlando, who had taken on the mafia in Palermo, comes to visit Joseph O'Dell. And he says, Joseph, we're going to make you an honorary citizen. He hands him his certificate of citizenship of Palermo. He brings letters from the children of Palermo. And he said, Joseph, if they kill you, we will not let you be buried on Virginia soil. We will ship your body to Palermo and you will be in a graveyard. He describes it. Got trees growing. It's on the hillside. We're going to bury you in an honorary place. Well, can you imagine the prison at Virginia? Here's the mayor from Palermo, and they hear mafia, they hear, and they, you know, they're prison and they think security, security. The night of Joseph's execution, there were helicopters circling the prison. There were orange cones all the way down the highway and people with guns because somehow they got the signal that the mafia was going to come and rescue Joseph Odell out. And with all the Italians, they're getting 10,000, the governor, 10,000 faxes and phone calls. Do not kill Joseph Odell. They couldn't wait to kill Joseph Odell. I mean, imagine the governor of Virginia going, what? And then the Pope calls. Pope John Paul, the Vatican calls. Mother Teresa calls from Calcutta. And he was holding the phone, the governor, the people in there. Because, you know, Mother Teresa, everybody thinks, oh, Mother Teresa, she took care of the poor of Calcutta. But, man, don't get her started on justice. I mean, because she was going. And they could hear the governor going, but mother. So the phone call I get one day is Lori. She goes, and her expression was, sugar. She goes, Sister Helen, sugar, listen to this. The Italians are bringing me over to Italy and allowing me to speak in towns all across Italy for Joseph's case. The Italian parliament has passed a resolution for Joseph, and they're going to bring me to see the Pope. You could come with me, because like aren't nuns and popes like tight? And you could talk to the Pope about the death penalty. Did I want to talk to the Pope about the death penalty? From the time I'd started in Louisiana, the Catholic Church's position, like many Christian churches, it was very compromised because it came out of a tradition where the church said to protect society, to defend society. And remember now, towns and villages in the past didn't have prisons. And you had a very violent person. So they said, to protect in self-defense for society, you can kill the criminals. But things were changing. More and more countries in the world. We had the UN Declaration of Human Rights, that people had a right to life and not to be tortured and killed. And so the world's changing about that. And so, yes, I wanted to have a conversation with Pope John Paul about the death penalty. Because in my own state of Louisiana, with the bishop of New Orleans had been a military guy, and he was all for the death penalty, so the bishops weren't issuing any kind of statements. And I'm going, that's not the gospel of Jesus to pull a switch on people. I mean, this isn't what it really means to be a Christian. And so what happened is I wrote a letter, and Laurie delivered it to Pope John Paul. And in it, I got to say the things, because dialogue is really important. And being any kind of community, in our community, in our city community, in our church community, or dialogue, when you get a chance to do dialogue, you got to tell the truth. And I had 14 years of experience of accompanying people, and I laid it in the Pope's lap. And I said, we need to firm up the stand of the Catholic Church so that it's principled opposition to the death penalty, no exceptions. And I said, is it only in your encyclical, the pastoral letter the Pope had written, it talked about the inviolable dignity of innocent life? I said, is it only innocent people that have dignity? When I'm walking with someone to execution and they say, Sister, please pray that God holds up my legs. They're shackled, hand and feet. They've been rendered defenseless. And they're going to be strapped down and killed. There is no dignity in this death. And I said, in your pastoral letter, called the Gospel of Life, you pushed the death penalty to the edge, but you left a real huge loophole in it. You said in cases of absolute necessity, even though you said the death penalty should be rare, and if not non-existent, and societies have a way to defend ourselves because we have prisons, we don't need to use the death penalty. But then you left this big old loophole and you said, but in cases of absolute necessity, the state can execute. And I said, Your Holiness, any time a country executes, they're going to claim it's an absolute necessity. And your words are going to be quoted for death. And providentially, in New Orleans, Harry Connick Sr., who went for the death penalty every chance he got, his son is Harry Connick Jr., does a pretty music, And here's the daddy going for the death penalty. Good Catholic man, going to Mass every Sunday, pushing for that death penalty. And he had had the traditional teaching of the church to back him up. But then he quotes the Pope's words. Like he said, we can't get enough death sentences here in New Orleans. He said, every one we get's an absolute necessity. And I could just lay those words in the Pope's lap. Say, your words are being quoted for death. What they did was they changed the official teaching of the church in the catechism. And they changed it and they cut out the criteria the church had used for 1700 years to determine when the state could execute for a grave or grievous crime. They cut out that criteria. In other words, because we have a way to defend ourselves as a society without killing people, no matter how grave or grievous the crime, the gravity of the crime is no longer the determinant about what we're going to do. Because crimes are going to be terrible. The killing of one human being is the loss of a universe that can never be replaced. No matter how grave or grievous the crime, they remove that criteria. We are not to take life. Because it has a lot more to do with us and who we are as a society. One time a man was about to be executed. He had done a terrible crime. I cannot remember his name. It was an unspeakably terrible crime, and I remember that the journalists were talking to him the day before he was to be executed. One of the journalists said, Mr. So-and-so, look at what you did. Can you give me one good reason why this state shouldn't execute you tomorrow? And he looked at him and he said, because you're better than I am. And it's a lot about us and what kind of society we're going to be. And when I write books, I take you with me through the experiences. I do research, I learn, and you get a chance to learn too. But it's not a polemic. It's not to try to beat you over the head. It's not to say anybody's more virtuous than anybody else. But just to say it's worth thinking about, and you're not going to have any way of getting close to this except through eyewitnesses who are going to take you there and just say, let me tell you. Let me tell you what I saw. Let me tell you what I learned. And then you make up your own mind. And that's what I offer you in The Death of Innocence. It's a book. And you know, a book is a precious thing. Because when you open the pages of this book, you begin. It's very private. It's like you're in a cloister. You don't have to defend any arguments. You don't have to argue with anybody. You can go to page 32 back and forth three times if you want to. You go at your own pace. You learn information, and you're using your own imagination as the stories are playing out in front of you, which is a very intimate experience. And it can take you into worlds that you otherwise wouldn't visit. And I hope you can trust the storyteller in this book to take you through and tell you the truth so that what I experience, you can experience too. So let me just stop here, and maybe we can have a little discussion together. And then I'll be glad to sign books for you as long as you want to be here. And we have things for the play of Dead Man Walking that we'll make available to you too. So how about some conversation together? Either a question or a comment or anything. Yes. Well, what happened was the Pope took it, when he took that, if you think of it like a tripod, the traditional teaching, the state has a right to take life. In self-defense of society for grave or grievous crimes. The Pope took out one leg about how can we call it defense of society when we have a way to defend society. We don't have to kill people. He said bloodless means, which is more respectful of human life. He had knocked that out already. But it was for grave or grievous crimes. See, and how do you determine that? And that's been the swamp we're in this country. What is the worst of the worst? You know what it's turning out to be? Well, 87% of the 1,000 people executed, it's because they kill white people. So evidently the first requirement for worst of the worst is, did you kill a white person? I mean, here was a young 14-year-old girl taken into the woods by three young men and brutally killed and raped, her throat slashed, left to bleed in the woods. Well, that sure seems like the worst of the worst to me. Can we even picture anything worse than that? And they all went to trial, and nobody got the death penalty. But that young 14-year-old girl's name was Virginia Smith, and she was African-American. And the kids were white, and their daddies knew the DA. How even when we say, God, that's a terrible crime, surely justice, who is going to be the agent of the justice, and how are we going to have the wisdom to be able to apply this thing? And boy, we got a track record now. We've been doing it for 30 years, and you just look at it. It's got nothing to do with deterrence. Generally, the states that practice the death penalty the most have the highest homicide rate. Look at Texas. Look at us. Look at Virginia. It's got nothing to do with that, and it is costly. New York had the death penalty for 9 years, and they finally put it down. The Supreme Court overturned it, and the people didn't put it back. They had hearings. You know what? They had spent over $180 million to keep that machinery of death in place for 9 years. Think where $180 million could have gone with at-risk kids or places for kids to get off drugs. Think what we could do. Money is not just a practical thing. We say over here we have the moral discussion. Martin Luther King used to say the most moral document you'll ever look at is a budget. And look how we are spending money in the United States. Somebody else. Yes. He confessed that he had killed the boy. He confessed that he had done it. And you don't know that till that part of the movie. Because he keeps doing the flashbacks, and you see it in various versions. So only toward the end does he confess that. Now remember, the movie, Matthew Ponsell is a composite. Now, there are two people in Dead Man Walking. Patrick Saunier, very remorseful. Robert Lee Willie, very tough. And the composite of those two was Matthew's Ponsulate. And Tim Robbins said, in this movie, we're not going to take somebody innocent. Everybody knows you shouldn't kill the innocent. We're going to have somebody guilty, because then you say, well, what about him? We know he did it, so why can't we kill him? And to take people there. And the other thing he did, too, was he changed it from the electric chair to lethal injection, because he said more and more states are introducing lethal injection, because that's supposed to be a humane way to kill human beings. Yes. Michael Morales in California. What's happening tonight? They really don't know. I've been talking to the American people for 20 years. You know what it is? They haven't thought deeply about it. The American people, I've been, you know, over to England. I've been in Belgium. I've been in Australia. I've been in, and it's not that the American people are any more vengeful than people. We haven't thought deeply about it. And Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court Justice, the real first African-American Supreme Court Justice, he said, look, the American people say they support the death penalty, but it's an unreflected opinion. Give people education about the death penalty, and they will reject it. And for 20 years, that's what we've been doing. And I'm telling you, I've been to audiences in Texas, I mean, Virginia, and people go, say, what? Well, we didn't know it was like that. I mean, and they don't. How do you do deep reflection on the social and moral issues of our day? How do we get deep reflection in our culture? Yeah, well, you got religion, you got education, you got bookstores, and you got churches and synagogues and mosques, and you got art. Art brings you deep, too. Yes, in the back there. You grew up in Destrehan? Watch out, y'all got Louisiana people all over the place here. All right. Yeah, you got to speak up. Come up to the front. If you can do it from the side, you can do it in the front.
Oh, okay. All right, good.
My comment and question is for guidance on the following issue. The Denver Post is doing a series on sentencing of non-adult criminals, and I read it, or started to read, the first installation this past weekend. And when you mentioned that it's not an accident that death row inmates are comprised mostly as African-American males, and the executions occur in former slaveholding southern states, I wonder how, and I know there's a correlation, poverty may be one, weakness two, meaning lack of resources, but what's the correlation between the increase in adult sentencing of children, essentially, for their crimes, heinous crimes, surely, some of them, and the increase in even the death penalty being available to prosecutors for minors? So I guess what I'm thinking is crystallizing for me is, yes, you can say it's African Americans, males, low IQ, poverty, lack of resources. How then do prosecutors get away with essentially killing children for their crimes? I mean, what?
Well, they can't do the death penalty for juveniles.
But they can do, they can try them as adults and then sentence them to life in prison, which.
14, 15 years.
Right. So I guess I don't even know if I have a question.
Well, no, you have a question, but I got a comment on what you're saying.
Okay.
There's a trend.
That I want you to speak to the trend, because it's
right.
Disturbing, number one, to know what you've said to us tonight. And as a person who grew up in Louisiana, I'm well aware of it, but it's even more disturbing that children are getting now the same treatment. So if fear of black violence against whites drives executions, then what drives prosecuting children in this manner?
Have you noticed this? Yeah, you did great. Thank you. Yeah. Have you noticed this? Like when our legislature meets in Louisiana, I just put my head in my hands because I just... What they do is they think of more and more punishments to do against criminals. We have moved into such a punitive mode, punish the criminals. Some of it was backlash from the 70s when civil rights... And you had Miranda rights, and they said the criminals got too many rights, the victims don't have any rights, and there's been a backlash. And it's still continuing, like, these kids did these terrible crimes, they could do a terrible crime of an adult, so we'll punish them as an adult. And it's part of this punitive, and it's tied to politics. Because people get political points for saying they're tough on crime. And they're pushing it and pushing it so that you have these unspeakable stories. If Charles Dickens, were alive today, he'd be writing. These would be the Oliver Twist stories of today, taking young people and sentencing them as adults and sending them to adult prisons. It's unspeakable what we're doing. The mandatory drug sentencing is unspeakable. The number of women that are now in prisons and separated from their children and family because of drug crimes. And what's pushing all this? Politics is pushing it. These guys look tough. They're punishing criminals. The death penalty's part of it, and all of this is part of that trend. What's the only way to change it? Is for them to hear from us. And when prosecutors are getting ready to do a case, and we can see that they're going to go for this, for the citizens to write to them, to call them, and say, don't you do this to that kid. You don't need to do this to protect us as citizens. If they never hear from the citizens, they're going to keep doing what they're doing because they're going to go for the political points in it. It really does come down to us a lot. And I found this out about legislators because I've been to a lot of places and talked, you know, and been part of when legislatures are dealing with these issues. And I can tell you this. If they get a lot of letters from their constituents, it really does affect them. And if we don't speak out, then they're going to keep going down this road. We really need to take a personal interest. You've reading in the paper that here's this prosecutor going for this, and it's a young person involved. And if you call your friends and 10 people call the prosecutor's office, if 20, if 50 call, why are you doing this? Or we'd like to come see you. We're citizens in the community. Why are you doing this? It's just pure accountability. And as long as they don't have accountability, they're going to keep doing it. That's what I think. Yes. Yeah. Well, now they do have it because of the decision, you know, for Atkins. Oh, yeah, no, that's right. Well, hopefully, you know, I mean, you know, when you meet Justice Scalia in this book, he goes duck hunting with my brother Louis, all right? Louis's also been duck hunting with Cheney. I'm glad my little brother's alive. But when you read the arguments here about Atkins, of why you shouldn't execute juveniles, and here you have Justice Scalia who says, whatever the framers say, this fundamentalist approach to the Constitution. And they said, well, unless a person was an idiot, couldn't count change, or didn't know their mother and father. That's the standard he wants to apply. As if we haven't had psychology and a growth in psychology and understanding of the human person over 200 years. I mean, it drives me wild that he does this. And he never saw Dobie. And his was one of the decisions that helped Dobie be killed. You know, but they're so removed. I picture him like having five pairs of gloves on. And they're removed from the human pain and the consequences of these decisions. And that step, and plenty of people have mental illness, sickness. I've heard the statistic that over 90% of people on death row were abused as children. And I'm sure in prison the number's high. The violence pumped into them in their lives, one day they explode on others. I mean, what do you think of that? I mean, you did this for 10 years, and so you were with prisoners, and what did you notice? Yeah. 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 Well, I mean, Justice Scalia said, they know right from wrong. And I mean, I've heard prosecutors at trials in Louisiana say, he knows right from wrong. You know, the classic case was this guy Green in California that everybody knew was crazy. I mean, everybody. The warden, but the state wants to kill him. And so the prosecutor, they get a state examiner to go and meet with him. And she said, as part of her report, and we played tic-tac-toe, and he won half the time. Now, enter into this picture this woman, what is her name, Charlotte Holman. She had seen on TV that there was a chicken, and they had a big tic-tac-toe thing, and the chicken, they would put ink on the chicken's feet, and the chicken played against somebody, and the chicken won half the time. So when Charlotte Holman, now this is a great warrior for these people on death row. She started in Florida and she's doing it in California. So they're having the hearing in front of the judge. And here's the state examiner saying, he's not mentally, you know, and intelligence, he won half the time at tic-tac-toe. And there's Charlotte. Because I talked to the lawyers that had to do the research to go find the chicken. So they really knew what was involved here. And Charlotte Holman says, Your Honor, we'd like to just present as part of this that I can either bring the chicken before Your Honor, or I can show you this video that it shows a chicken can win half the time too. So that doesn't really prove anything. That will not be necessary, Ms. Holman. We're not having a chicken come in this courtroom. But that's how bad it can get. That state examiners, of course, always want to find for the state whatever they want them to. Yeah. Well, that's sweet. No, you know what, though? It's anything. Here's the for justice. And I'm going to go to Archbishop Tutu here, who says, if you're standing by and you see an elephant standing on the tail of a mouse, you can't fold your arms and stand there and say, I'm neutral. The mouse will not appreciate that you say you're neutral. When we become aware of an injustice in our society, in our own emotions, you know, I'm hoping it enrages people. I'm hoping people go, oh, this, we can't allow this in the United States of America. And that you begin to act. You're going to be surprised how liberating it is to begin to take action. Because when it's all bottled up and you don't know where to go with it, it's a terrible, painful thing. Because you know you're being called to act. But what? So you read in the paper that here's a prosecutor going to go for the death sentence. Or here, you know, who's your legislator? are they beginning to get letters from people and just say, why do we still have the debt? Look what it has cost Colorado to have the death penalty. All this time we got two people on death row after 25 years. Why don't we use to begin to do something? Begin to do something. And then in the action, in Latin America they say the path is made by walking. You take that one step and the other unfurls under you. And you begin, and then you begin to look, who's working on this? Who are other people concerned about this? And you join with others in the community, because lone rangers don't last long in justice. You got to be with other people. Okay, folks, well, we could go on a long time, but I got to get to signing those books, and I'll be glad to talk to you individually while we're doing the books. But thanks to Tattered Books, what is it called? Oh, excuse me, Tattered Cover. And don't forget about the play. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, Allegra Goodman, John Grogan, Rita Mae Brown, Francis Mays, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on February 21st, 2006.